You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, I'm with Daniela Peled and Oscar Guardiola Rivera to talk through the day's top news stories. We'll ask how to buy an election. We'll look at the shaky future of Brexit. We'll see what the Pope's up to in Colombia. And we'll find out why Democrats are scared of Hillary Clinton's book tour. And we'll also analyse the soft power of Syrian sport. All that and much, much more coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck, the University of London. Welcome both to the programme. Now, let's begin our roundup of stories here in the UK, where this week we've seen leaked immigration proposals for a post-Brexit Britain. A leaked government memo has declared that free movement will end as soon as the UK withdraws from the EU on the 29th of March 2019. Meanwhile, the EU's chief negotiator has this week said that the UK appears to be going backwards on agreeing a Brexit financial settlement. Hopes of a divorce deal now appear to be in the gutter. Daniela, we can look at these grim headlines every single day, I think, for the next year and beyond. But these latest headlines are about the movement of people, what's going to happen, and just the air of uncertainty that they have created for anybody who's leading a life here, who wanted to lead a life here. Britain's entering a really kind of weird period where it's deliberately, it seems, making itself very unattractive.
Well, absolutely. It's also a period of uncertainty for the British citizens who are living in the EU as well. And theoretically, that anyone who is here now will continue to have full rights. But there's been talk of, you know, the government's documents talked of fingerprints and identification papers. And it all adds up to create this sort of phantasm that foreigners are basically criminals in waiting, which I think is part of the discourse that fueled Brexit in general, and also the idea, still clinging to this, the idea that immigration is bad for the economy, whereas it looks like in March 2019, with all the signs pointing to a hard Brexit, that actually the damage to our economy will be massive.
Now, one of the things that's come out today and a little bit yesterday is that many people in the EU think it would be illegal anyway for them to put up these barriers immediately on the date that we begin to leave the EU, because there's going to be a transition period. And it seems that everybody's saying that you can't start discriminating against highly skilled and non-skilled workers overnight. If there was a transition period, you'd have to allow continued free movement of all people. Do you think, Oscar, you know, that many of the things we're seeing are just a little bit ill thought out at the moment?
Oh, completely. Probably the whole thing, if it has been thought out at all. The more we get to know about the detail of these negotiations, the more we learn that the whole thing has been ill-prepared and ill-thought. It isn't just about these particular stories concerning the impact that this is going to have on EU nationals living here. We already know that this is having an impact on the capacity of EU nationals in Britain to access credit, for instance. The banks are not lending to EU nationals because they consider them now at risk. And something similar is happening to EU nationals' access to private renting. The fact that a defunded home care system and other services is also going to converge with less numbers of EU nationals entering as a much needed workforce. All of this is creating a perfect storm. And on top of all this, there is a constitutional crisis in the making. What is being discussed today in Parliament is whether the ministers of cabinet will have the power to pretty much decide on their own what is technical in terms of EU law being brought within the fold of British law. And if so, they will have the capacity to make law as they see fit. And this is a power grab by the executive, the kinds of which are historically unprecedented.
And this, Daniel, is maybe where there'll be some kind of pushback from even some Tories who feel that, you know, what's happening here is wrong, not just in the sense of the legislation, but in this sense of there being a power grab. We know that there's going to be a whip for the Labour Party to vote against this legislation. But do you think there's any damage that can be done to the bill at this stage?
Well, you're absolutely right, because plenty of people within the Conservative Party are already saying that this is, you know, this is unacceptable. They're calling this a Henry VIII legislation, with a very convincing argument that it's all very well to say, oh, it's fine, we'll have these powers, but we won't misuse them. One Labour member of Parliament today said, looking at the possibilities that the next Tory leader might be Jacob Rees-Mogg, who he described as member, honourable member for the 18th century, and someone who has extremely, extremely retrograde views.
Probably too modern.
Yes, 18th century might be too modern. So, yeah, and there are plenty of MPs in the Tory party of more liberal bent who see a severe constitutional problem with this and say, you know, the whole argument for Brexit was to get sovereignty back. Well, this is delegating sovereignty to an elite executive.
I spoke to someone the other day who's working on the high-speed rail project, and they were saying that they will need tens of thousands of labourers to do this work. Not highly skilled people, labourers. And they said that their access to those was going to vanish if this legislation was pushed through. They also pointed out they worked for a design firm where of 300 employees working in London, 15 were British nationals. Now, that hemorrhaging of talent at the top, but also the hemorrhaging of actually good people who can, you know, dig a tunnel, put up a bridge, lay some cables. We need the less skilled people as well, don't we, Oscar?
Absolutely. I mean, people in this country have been told a lie. There is no question about it. We're now seeing it. The problem is that, of course, you want to believe in this country. You want to believe in this country's ability to put up, stand up, and pull through. But the reality of the situation with Brexit is that we have a hemorrhaging of labor force at the top and at the bottom, who will be needed. We are also beginning to see problems with middle-class people, access to services. It is as if the boat is beginning to leak, in all places. And that points towards a really messy near future. This is a self-inflicted wound. It was inflicted politically. Let us hope it can be stopped politically.
Just a tiny thing before I move on. In your world of academia, you know, many people from around the world come here to teach in London, many from Europe. Are people even there in academia concerned about their futures?
Not only they're concerned, we have already seen numbers of our EU colleagues leaving the, you know, higher education institutions. You know, highly ranked scientists and cultivators of the humanities live in because of this uncertainty. We have also seen the numbers of students from abroad, not just from Europe, but from India. People don't know, for instance, that Sweden and France are about to overtake the UK in terms of the number of Indian students coming to study to their universities. That's really awkward. And it all points towards this emphasis on anti-immigration. This whole Brexit thing is boiling down to an ill-conceived fear of immigrants. And this is going to affect the economy. It is going to affect our political spirit. It is going to affect our intellectual life.
Well, and I've just been in Portugal, and it is amazing to hear that there is nobody there kind of begging for us to stay. And rather than being glum about their prospects, everyone feels rather up and positive and collegiate about how they see Europe functioning in the future. Well, another story we've been following is the announcement from Facebook that the company, that reps from the company told America's Congress yesterday that they sold ads to a shadowy Russian company during the US presidential campaign. The company, a so-called troll farm with a history of promoting pro-Kremlin propaganda, spent $100,000. This comes as a new report from the German Marshall Fund suggests that Russia has meddled in the affairs of at least 27 European and North American countries since 2004. Now, Daniel, we'll come to you first on this. So, first of all, it sounds, oh my God, this is terrible. $100,000 in American political campaigning, in the sense of funds, that buys you about 1 second of TV airtime. It's a nonsensically tiny amount of money to believe that it's really had any impact, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that's just one very, very small aspect of it. I think when we think about the Russian propaganda effort, we think of really blatant ventures like Russia Today or the Sputnik news agency, which is very obvious pro-Russian propaganda. But actually, Russian disinformation and Russian effort to meddle in the affairs of other countries much more sophisticated than that, and really on a huge scale. You mentioned the troll farms, enormous internet campaigns, some subtle, some not, across all social media platforms, and as well in the Russian-speaking media across the Caucasus and Central Asia, really, really sophisticated attempts to change the public discourse, which I think in many cases have been very, very successful. What happened with Facebook, I think, is more about the changing role that social media institutions have. Facebook and Twitter and so on like to position themselves as just platforms, just conduits for information, and they say we have no editorial contribution, you know, we're hands off, we're just a platform. Well, that doesn't work anymore. With all the attention over fake news, and even Facebook has started to take action over that. So I think we're going to see Facebook and other platforms really accepting that they're more in the role of editorial providers, of content providers, and so they have to take responsibility for that as well.
Oscar, I guess, you know, when you think about Russian meddling, you're thinking, okay, they wanted to get Trump elected, you know, they were hitting Hillary hard, but in fact Facebook didn't really want to reveal who was the target of the ads, but it did say that actually most of the ads were less kind of focused than that. They were more about causing disquiet, so they were upping the ante on anti-LGBT issues. They were getting involved in the gun debate. They were talking about race issues. So more as a provocateur. It doesn't seem very clear what their intention was, whether it was to move the election or just kind of mess things up a bit.
Well, we have known for a while that in the world of international affairs, something has been changing. Rather than direct intervention, some powers, not only Russia but also others, have see fit to try and disrupt and destabilize the internal affairs of a country. But of course, in terms of this particular story, what the U.S. Congress really wanted to know from Facebook was whether there was any coordination between one of the U.S. presidential campaigns, specifically the Trump campaign, and these Russian troll farms. Now, Facebook security advisor argued in Congress that they had no means to actually provide that causality link. But it does tell us that this story is not just about, as you pointed out correctly, small amount of dollars buying or not an election. But this is about the case that is being mounted by the U.S. Special Prosecutor. They're looking for that sort of smoking gun, whether there was or not a collusion between the Trump campaign and these disinformation techniques. If there was, then we go into another side of this story, which involves the possibility of a constitutional crisis in the United States if the president is seen as obstructing.
And your sense of what you've heard so far, do you think there is a smoking gun here?
Not here, but the case is mounting. I've been talking to some people very close to the Clintons and in previous weeks, and they're saying that they think the special prosecutor has enough evidence. If that is the case, then we enter into another act of this drama, in which the power of the president has over the special prosecutor might turn him against Congress, because Congress is clearly trying to, secure its own position. They know that the special prosecutor is under the control of the presidency of the U.S. So they're trying to, either put into statute the terms of the investigation and so on. And if that is the case, then the chances for a clash between the U.S. Congress and the president become much more probable. Hence, the possibility of a constitutional crisis there.
Daniel, just one tiny thing before we move on. Yeah, I understand all this, and it's obviously important who wants Russia meddling in your election, but it also seems to be a little bit of a distraction. We're going to move on in a minute to Hillary, but the Democrats also lost because they didn't run a good campaign, and it still feels sometimes like they're looking for a bit of a scapegoat that, it was because of this meddling. And this meddling seems to be an annoyance and not helpful. But really, did it swing the election? It seems maybe we get a bit too caught up about the impact it could have had.
I'm not sure. I think if we step back and take a wider view at the scale of Russian ambitions, I mean, you look at the list of 27 countries that it's interfered with in the last 15 or so years, there are a lot of obvious ones, the UK, Georgia, all these countries that are in the Russian sphere of influence, but it also includes countries like Portugal and Cyprus. I mean, one can only imagine that's to do with Russian business interests. But Canada, in spreading propaganda in Canada, in France, I think it shows that Russia is a superpower and it wants to have its levers of influence, covering an enormous spread of controls. And the American elections, is the peach, but there's an awful lot else there as well.
And of course, the interesting thing is, Americans have never done that. So they've never interfered in anyone else's elections.
Have you been ironic?
I'm being very ironic.
Very.
Let's stick with the 2016 presidential election, however, in the US for a moment. Hillary Clinton, last year vanquished presidential candidate, has written a book about that period in her life, and Democrats are apparently dreading the thought of reliving the campaign during her upcoming tour. Daniela, anything good can come out of this book and poring over, as we said, what went horribly wrong?
Well, for Hillary, yes. I mean, this is a real big sort of up yours to all her previous adversaries and supposed allies as well. I mean, she has a real go apparently at Bernie Sanders, at Obama, at well, that would be quite legitimate. Say Biden. I mean, what will she achieve out of this? Nothing, apart from feeling a lot better about herself at the end of it. I mean, the Democrats are really not happy about it, because really what they need to do is, as you said, perhaps stop blaming all these other outside actors for their defeat and start looking forward to 2018 and 2020. So this kind of negative story does them no good whatsoever. But I have to say, I think it will be quite an entertaining read. Part of me thinks, good on you, Hillary. Get it out of your system. What's waiting for her? A future political career, maybe head of the UN or some other sort of supranational body. So she's got scores to settle, and gosh, she's settling them big style.
Because, Oscar, the interesting thing is, I'm like, European politics, where if somebody loses and steps down, then, another party leader comes along. That doesn't happen with, American politics. It's going to be a long time before there is a new effective leader of the Democrats. Now, with Hillary doing this, she kind of stays in the spotlight as, her, Obama, Nancy Pelosi. It's still the old crew that everybody has to look to for their opinions of the state of the party, what lies ahead. And again, as Dan is saying, the risk is that she will draw in all the light, and once again, she will be the key spokesperson for the Democratic Party.
In fact, apparently, some of the people, the ad people advising potential Democratic candidates are already tweeting their clients, Hillary's going to be within 500 miles of you, so, just go somewhere else or take the rally somewhere else. I don't think anything good will come out of this for the Democrats. Democrats. I'm sure plenty of book sales for Hillary. And yes, as we just heard, she wants to blame everybody but herself, which is not a good way of moving forward. Many members of the Democratic Party have pointed out that at this moment in time, the party needs a show of unity, and this will not give them that.
Daniel.
Yeah, just one quick point, though. I think often, really, when parties lose elections, they deserve to lose, and they need a bit of time in the wilderness, and they need to put their own house in order and suffer a little bit before they can rebuild themselves. So I don't think the Democrats can blame Hillary now for their own failures as well.
But when you look at what's happened, the adjustments have happened in the Democratic Party, it still remains very unclear whether they have got their house in order. They've had some good attempts at stopping a few bits of legislation, but there's not a very kind of a cohesive sense of what the future of the Democratic Party should be.
No, there isn't at all. I mean, people are talking about Biden for 2020 presidential candidate.
Oh,
and I mean, great, but, you know, he's come on, let's move forward a little bit. But as you said, in American politics, it's not that transition is not as smooth and it's not as predictable. And I think there is an element, there is going to be a sort of caretaker period for the Democrats while they, you know, sort out their direction and where they're going.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. Up next, we'll look at the Pope's visit to Colombia and the soft power role of sport in politics.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and I'm still with Daniela Peled from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck, the University of London. To Colombia now, where Pope Francis landed yesterday to kick off a five-day trip. He was met by President Juan Manuel Santos, who focused his presidency on a peace deal that's been finalised in December with the FARC rebel group. Oscar, what's the Pope's ambitions for this trip?
This is a political trip. As you know, this will come as no surprise to most of our listeners. The Catholic Church carries a lot of political weight in Latin America. But in this particular case, it has to do with the fact that there are elections next year in Colombia, and the probability that those who oppose the peace process win the election is considerable. So the first words that Pope Francis gave about this visit are quite significant. He told the Colombian people, and particularly the Colombian youth, not to allow themselves to be lied to, not to fall for the tricks of those who spread partial truths or alternative facts. And that was a clear jab at those who oppose the peace process in Colombia. And it has been interpreted as such by the media in Colombia. So that's the purpose of the visit. He's going to go, this is very significant, to the eastern plains, the part of the country that was the actual theater of war. He's going to meet there some 5,000 victims of the conflict. So this is quite significant. He's not just going to talk to the president. He's going to talk to the those who fell because of fell victims of this war.
And in Colombia, will people listen to him? Do you think that they will bide his suggestion that they ignore the critics of the peace deal?
They will listen. Whether this will, whether this will be enough is another matter, because Part of what is happening in Colombia is that there is a bit of a toxic mixture between religion and politics. Those who oppose the peace deal are also very often mixing up, anti-Catholic religious sentiments from what in Colombian parlance they call Christian sects. And in fact, the potential opponent of whomever Juan Manuel Santos designates as his successor is a man who is a Lefebvreist. He goes against the teachings of the Catholic Church. So this is going to be an interesting match.
Daniela, the Pope is a diplomat. Do you think he does a good turn as one?
In lots of contexts, he does, and I think here actually his message is. Is particularly important because the people that voted against the referendum were not necessarily voting against peace because they didn't want a peace deal, but they felt that the FARC were being allowed to just get away with too much. And it wasn't so simple just to lay down your arms and just be reabsorbed in society, magically turn yourself into a political party. The issue of transitional justice is very, very important in any peace deal and any movement from a state of war to a state of peace. It really can't be overemphasized enough. And it's one of these cases, I think, where the Pope spreading a message of reconciliation is likely to have an impact. I mean, now we're talking about people's feelings and people's perceptions of the peace deal and what will happen next. That's where the work needs to be done.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear more of the trip. But finally on the show, can sport bring together a nation? Well, Syria may be on track for qualifying for the 2018 World Cup in Russia after drawing 2-2 against Iran. Though many Syrians are proud, some are wary that the Syrian regime, currently waging a deadly civil war, is using the team's recent success for political purposes. Oscar, should Syrians be cheering or Syrians be wary about the success on the pitch?
Difficult to say. The one precedent I can think of is the 1978 World Cup final in Argentina. The regime clearly tried to use the success of its football team to ramp up its power. This was the dictatorial regime in Argentina back then, and quite a few members of the football team refused to heed to that, but some of them, Valdano in particular, I remember writing about how when they were down in before coming into the pitch, they could hear the screams of some of the tortured because the stadium happens to be just nearby the Navy's that infamous headquarters of the Navy, where many of the disappeared were being tortured.
That's not the best football story, but tell me, Daniel, it's interesting. I guess the Syrians who've stayed in Syria, it's obvious that they will be cheering on the team. But for the diaspora now, who are around the world, these must be like incredibly bittersweet moments where you're still proud of your heritage and the country you came from, but you find very few things to hold on to. Do you think it's a moment where people should get behind the team or not?
It really isn't. It really isn't. Any claims that the Syrian team is uniting as a moment of unity and a moment of national pride are completely bogus. There's a couple of players on the team that were pro-opposition. The idea that they've been brought back and included in the team as some form of national reconciliation is just nonsense. The team isn't representing Syrian nation, people or culture. The team is representing the regime, as simple as that. And I know that there's this great effort to say that sports can rise above power politics and these universal ideals. In this case, that's not true at all.
And Oscar, just finally tell me, you come from a continent where football, it does seem to rise above many situations of poverty, of disadvantage, to unify people. What is it about sports in Latin America that is so successful at doing that?
Well, mainly because of the class provenance of footballers. They almost always come from very humble backgrounds. So people tend to rally behind that, not necessarily behind the politics. Football and politics in Latin America are as intertwined as they are everywhere else. And that may be a good thing, but it can also be a complicated thing.
Well, thank you for the sports news. That brings us to the end of today's show. Daniela Peled and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Daphne Karnizis and also by Sophia Armadi. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next, and at 1900 hours, it's The Urbanist. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on The Monocle Daily. But for now, goodbye.